Good afternoon, Seattle. Dr. Fraser Crane. If you can feel, I can heal. It's Sunday morning. I've just come in from night shift. I'm very tired. But if you listen, I'm having a bath and I think there's something to be said about soaking in a tub of your own filth that just induces something quite reflective in me. I don't know. So I just wanted to share something. I've been thinking, I've listened back to the opening two casts that I've done about 600 times. It seems to have taken the place of music now for me, my voice. I realise that, you know, singing wise, lush, velvety, other fantastic adjectives and superlatives abound. I'll not bore you with those, but just speaking wise, there's something very, very lovely about my own voice that is really conducive to me getting a good night's sleep. So I just stick the podcast on loop. So now I realise that this has become more of just a... It's taken the place of the orca whale and rainforest for me. So that's maybe good enough reason for me to continue with this little endeavour. But if I could be serious for a minute... could I be serious for a minute? I was thinking about, I was saying to a dear friend yesterday that there's a danger. I found it quite dangerous. I enjoyed doing the first two, but it is quite dangerous because I'm essentially speaking into the ether to an intangible. Well, I'm hoping there's enough ears out there to constitute an audience. So it's weird. It's not entirely reciprocal. And I have mentioned before that perhaps this is a locum for a therapist. Now the irony there is when I said that I don't think I was fully aware that was why I was doing this. But it's quite a, you know, Socratic thing. This truth in conversation, I think, was something more Socrates said. He said a lot of shit, though. You know, he said a wise man realizes he knows nothing. Something like, I don't know what I'm talking about. keep up. But this is something I've realized during, I did cognitive behavioral therapy about. I think I was discharged as an outpatient about a year and a half ago. And within those sessions, I acknowledged that, you know, you get sort of prompts and asked to expand. And depending on your responsiveness to the therapy, I mean, I was very open because I knew that if I wasn't, it would be a complete waste of time for everyone involved, chiefly myself. But I used to reflect and say to the analyst that I didn't realise I actually felt half the things I now acknowledge, and that wasn't until I said them out loud, that wasn't until we conversed, and that I think that's why, and then that happened within one of the earlier podcasts. I realised that's why I'm doing this, and yeah, it's kind of meta, it's ironic that I realised that through talking out loud to, an iPhone. So, yeah, there's that. I have that. And it got me thinking back to when I read, again, we're just tying into literature and so forth. When I read The Castle by Kafka, which really... I'm not going to say anything more about the castle that hasn't been said a bazillion times before by far more intelligent people, other than you should read it if you haven't read it. That's all I could really say about it. It really, 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 really struck a chord with me. And to be honest, though, I found a piece of writing by a guy called Idris Parry. I'm a fan of the Idris. I only know of another Idris, and he's canny. War Idris Elba. This guy's Idris Parry. I like that name. And I read this thing that he wrote in relation to the castle, subsequent to reading the castle, and I think I was actually moved more by this. And I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became a fan of Idris Parry. So I'm going to read it. It's a good few pages long. There's allusions to different mythological characters and poets like Rilke and so forth. I've just had to look up on YouTube. There's a thing called emmasayers.com I found, and whereby Emma, who is providing a really grand service to us all, pronounces things for you. So I've been able to overcome my, not entirely, because I'm sure I'll stumble over some other things and fumble and mess them up, but she helped me with things like, I looked up Rilke. I'm aware of the work and the name. I was not aware of how to say it. If I'm still saying it wrong, all these scholarly know-it-all Weisenheimers out there, then blame Emma. Go to emmasayers.com, write a very stern post, because the internet needs that kind of activity. There's not enough of that interaction of people putting in their two cents and complaining. So I'd like to read this thing. So pull up a pew, my friends, and I shall do my very best Vincent Price. No, I'm not going to do my Vincent Price voice. I'm just going to do my voice. We'll lean into voices later on, but I think it would do this a great disservice to dilute it with a silly voice. Let's give War Idris the respect he deserves, and ultimately Franz Kafka the respect he definitely deserves. More than I have given the man, having visited Prague twice, been in the titular castle. I never went to the Kafka Museum. Tried to get there twice, but I was pulled into the I can't even find a disgusting enough word for where I was dragged whilst in Prague. It involved men. Wait till I finish the sentence. It involved men, friends, and beer, and ladies of the night, shall we? I'm saying too much, but I'm being open. I'm trying to make sense of things. I think this, the reason I'm reading this before I go on to read it, I'm so poor at setting these things up, a ramble, is this really moved us, and I thought of it when I realised why I'm doing this podcast, other than to promote my debut album, The Dead Sea Tapes, available on markjameshammond.bandcamp.com, right now, in fact, is to make sense of things, to speak out loud, and try and find some truth in that very Socratic fashion, which is conveniently just very pretentious and very befitting of the intelligent gentleman. So here we go. This is by Idris Parry. If you hear any of that going on, I'm reading and simultaneously just getting the funk out of me toes. Here we go. Has there ever been so convoluted a mind revealed in utterance? Kafka believed his situation was unique. Nobody else could be so tormented by fear. The secret raven he talks about in his diaries. Does he exaggerate? I am given to exaggeration, he writes to Melina Yasenska, but all the same, I can be trusted. During the months from January to September 1922, when he is writing The Castle, the most important person in his life is Melina. Over this period, he writes to her constantly and without reserve. She is necessary to him. To you, he says, I can tell the truth, for your sake as well as mine, as to nobody else. Yes, it's possible to find one's own truth directly from you. In October 1921, he gave her all his diaries and never asked for them back, an almost unbelievable act of trust for such a private person. But this action was a logical consequence. In the diaries, he reveals his introspective self. In the letters to Melina, he exposes his fears, and therefore himself, as to no other correspondent. Nothing was to be hidden from her. His intention seemed so interlocked with her understanding that there was nothing to conceal, everything to discover. I can't listen simultaneously to the frightful voices from within and to you, he tells her, but I can listen to those and impart them to you as to nobody else in the world. These letters to Melina tell us about the state of mind he projects into prose as this novel. The frightful voices from within could, after all, be imparted to others. This intense relationship seems to have been an attraction of opposites. Melina was further from Kafka in external circumstances than any other woman in his life. She was 12 years younger, that would hardly matter to us, but he, at 38, thought she belonged to a different generation. She was already married, but unhappily, and the marriage was breaking up. He was Jewish, she was Christian, and seems to have been an extrovert. She lived in Vienna, inaccessible to the man from Prague except through complicated and baffling arrangements. There were no simple arrangements in Kafka's life. Today I saw a map of Vienna. For a moment I couldn't understand why they built such a great city when after all you need only one room. His letters are charged with painful analysis of the obstacles between them. For Kafka, any surface, even the surface of love, can generate its black swarm of disturbing possibilities. This is how life seems to him. Obstacles start from the ground wherever he looks. His Jewishness, passport difficulties, trains, lack of sleep, her husband, his own office obligations, his state of health, his sister's wedding. Disaster or distraction, and for him there is little difference between the two, surround him like a design for living. This is the design found in his fiction, which reflects a view of life as a proliferation of obstacles splitting off into more obstacles, bewildering the brain by their multiplicity, great film by Michael Keaton, and movement. His fears become almost laughable when he tells Melina he is afraid of lifting a tumbler of milk to his mouth because it could easily explode in my face, not by chance but by design, and throw the splinters into my face. His letters, hers have been lost, show their relationship growing in passionate and for him tormented love. Who else but Kafka could find hostility in happiness? It could burst in his face and really consist of the fragments into which he analyses it. He reviles himself for his inadequacy, for his fears, for the corrupting influence he brings to a life as natural and open as hers. This happiness is too terrifying. Love is to me that you are the knife which I turn within myself. In his diary, when he is writing The Castle, he describes life as a hesitation before birth. Not yet born and already compelled to walk the streets and talk to people. As usual, he exaggerates. All art has been called opportune exaggeration, and Kafka carries this to extremes. It is his method. In the novels and letters, as well as his diaries, feeling is given extraordinary form. Talking about hesitation before birth is his way of saying life appears to be a succession of loose ends, always provisional, a hesitant progression seemingly without connection or conclusion. Is this chance or design? He must believe in design behind the apparently accidental, or he would not assume birth beyond hesitation. He is not yet complete, not yet born. His correspondent is perhaps one who can complete him. He can address her as Mother Melina. He speaks of her life-giving power. She gives for him a kind of earth mother who can smooth into oblivion the hesitations of consciousness. He tells her he wants only to lay my face in your lap, feel your hand on my head, and stay like that through all eternity. Kafka and Melina met in Vienna for 4 days, the longest time they spent together. Later, Melina told a friend that Kafka forgot his fears. There was no need for the slightest effort, she said. Everything was simple and straightforward. His nervousness disappeared. But fear is not so easily lost, especially fear bred in the bone. I am always trying to convey something that can't be conveyed, he writes to her. To explain something which is inexplicable, to tell about something I have in my bones, something which can be experienced only in these bones. After Vienna, alone in his room with the paper on which he writes, he abandons himself again to fear. He confesses that the possibility of living with Melina does not exist. Those happy days become, in retrospect, merely a time when I looked over my fence, I held myself up by my hands, then I fell back again. To Kafka, the torment of love was that, like practically everything else, it created an indefinite fear which threatened the bounds of his strength. It is as if relationships to objects and events as well as people are visible to him only in the hieroglyphs of fear. Kafka's writing is an effort to find meaning in the central fact of his existence, and this central fact is inexplicable fear. In a strange way, this fear justifies his existence too, and we have the seeming paradox of the man who claimed he spent his life resisting the temptation to end it, also claiming that without fear he could not live. My life consists of this subterranean threat. If it stops, I'll stop too. It's my way of taking part in life. If it stops, I'll give up living as easily and naturally as a dying man closes his eyes. When life comes to him only as emanations of fear, it is important that this fear should be accurately observed. It is the material for his work and his hope. He either gives up or goes on. Kafka goes on. His fear, he tells Melina, is fear extended to everything, fear of the greatest as well as the smallest, fear, convulsive fear of pronouncing a word. Amen, sister. If there is hope, it is here, in its apparent opposite. One must give praise in spite of everything, says Rilke, and by praise the poet means unqualified acceptance of the material life, the material of life, however frightful or inexplicable. Truth cannot be found through omission or editing. In spite of everything, Kafka remains the curious observer. You forget, Melina, that we are standing side by side, watching this creature on the ground, which is me. The importance of these letters, apart from their evocative brilliance as human documents, is that here Kafka reveals exactly what he is transposing into the fictional skin called the castle. In his fiction, he is always talking about himself. I heard that. He told Felice Bauer, to whom he was twice engaged before he met Melina, that she had no cause to be jealous of the novel he was then writing, the book later called America. The novel is me, he said. I am my stories. Several entries in Kafka's diaries and notebooks show what a fascination the ancient myths had for him. Kafka's fictional writings often seem like modern legends or folktales about fear. This is no accident. The myth is a legend whose survival tells us it has enduring implications for the human mind. Here, events may seem impossible, but they linger in the deepest recesses of consciousness, pure fabrications. That is, fabrications recognisably pure. We are attracted outside to reason to these clear statements, which are simple, with a simplicity beyond our formulation of truth, and therefore inexplicable. These gods, messengers, impossible animals, impossible transformations, Daphne into the laurel tree, Arethusa into a fountain of fresh water, are fantasy made precise, but fantasy related to a conviction of truth. It is organic fantasy. If these are attempts to probe the mystery which is the relationship of the individual to his world, the images must seem to the rational mind remote and unreal. But they are not attempts to probe the mystery. They are attempts to present it, to give us a picture, to organise instinct into form, to explain by not explaining, which is the essence of poetry and the justification for art. In the same way, Kafka's story are not explanations but pictures. His heroes submit and endure. He writes and rewrites his versions of ancient legends, clearly looking for some meaning to connect them with his own experience. He has no difficulty in seeing himself, this creature writhing on the ground, as a modern Prometheus tormented by eagles tearing at his vitals, which never cease to grow. The legend of Prometheus is one Kafka rewrote for his own satisfaction, still writing about himself. The conclusion of his version is that the legend tries to explain the inexplicable. As he said to Melina, he himself is always trying to explain something which is inexplicable, but he never explains in the intellectual sense. True reality is always unrealistic, a friend records him as saying. Look at the clarity, purity and truth of a Chinese coloured woodcut. To talk like that would be something. Kafka makes pictures. Can there be hope if truth ends as it begins in the inexplicable? Or do we misunderstand the nature of hope? Writing is a positive and optimistic act, and Kafka must write or die. He is on record as saying the pen is not an instrument, but an organ of the writer's. In the month in which he starts to write The Castle, he speaks in his diary of the strange, mysterious, perhaps dangerous, perhaps saving comfort there is in writing. And in that letter to Melina, where he talks of listening to the frightful voices from within, he also speaks of his conviction that the fears themselves form a path to truth. Either that, or he has no access to truth. He has no other material. It is true, the letter continues, that this fear is perhaps not only fear, but also a longing for something which is more than all the things which produce fear. His life is fear, but is it possible that fear is simply a false interpretation of events? In The Castle, we find a double aspect surface which reflects duality in the writer. In one aspect, the surface as experience seems fragmentary, disconnected, and therefore inexplicable, a source of anxiety. In the other, there is dreamlike acceptance which implies belief in harmony beyond intellectual perception. The book is charged with essential fear, but also with essential hope, both together as they exist in the man. It is easy to classify Kafka's novels as catalogues of woe and handbooks of frustration, but he is presenting the evidence, the only evidence we have, and the writer starts from here. This evidence has to be absorbed. Accept your symptoms, says Kafka in his diary. Don't complain about symptoms. Immerse yourself in your suffering. This faith that revelation must and can come only from immediate suffering, the assault of experience, underlies many diary entries which seem puzzling if the images are not accepted as form given to innate belief, pictures of thought. Mount your attacker's horse and ride it yourself. Only possibility. But what strength and skill that demands, and how late it is already. And perhaps most pathetic and inspiring. Somewhere help is waiting, and the beaters are driving me there. The beaters are his experience of life, there to be endured in every trifling detail, for no detail is trifling. The Castle is nonsensical by rational standards. This is Kafka's way of saying reason is not enough. He has told us through Melina that he is always trying to explain the inexplicable, but he never explains. In The Castle, he makes no attempt to persuade the reader that events should follow like this. We are given a picture and told, in effect, this is how it is. The absurd is presented with such assurance, fantasy made so precise, that we are moved to follow as if by a law of induction. Perhaps art is simply induction. The picture in prose or paint or stone touches vibrations in us we did not know existed. We respond and understand beyond explanation. The secret understanding induced by art changes the structure before us from the absurd to the magical. And we know there is a common relationship between parts even if it can't be understood. A unity or coalescence like the one suggested when Kay tries to telephone The Castle and hears only a buzzing sound quite unlike anything he has ever heard before when using the phone. And it seems to him, the attentive listener, as if from this strange sound there emerges, in a quite impossible fashion, a single high-pitched yet powerful voice that struck the ear as if demanding to penetrate deeper than into mere hearing. In a unified world, nothing can be separate, and not even the senses. Vibrations are common and commonly observed, and it is primarily through sound that vibrations are perceptible, can even be seen to shake affected objects. Who can tell if the violin is silent when untouched by the bow? In The Castle, Kay lives in a space where magical connection is taken for granted. The strong erotic charge in the novel, which is a transposition of Kafka's passion for Melina, finds its climax when Kay and Frida make love amid the rubbish and puddles of beer on the floor of the bar at the Count's Arms, and Kay constantly had the feeling that he had lost his way or wandered farther into a strange land than anyone before him. A strange land where even the air held no trace of the air at home, where a man must suffocate from the strangeness, yet into whose foolish enticements he could do nothing but plunge on, getting even more lost. Apart from being a reasonably accurate description of the physical form of the novel as a strange land, this can also be taken as yet another commentary on the central theme of familiar and strange, reason and fantasy, caution and ambition, doubt and certainty. To understand beyond understanding, we too must be in a mood of acceptance. Our reason is bounded by perceptions which cover part of reality, not the whole. Kafka as an individual is not protected by the skin of habit and selective awareness. Each sentence in his works uncovers him, and one phrase in particular in his letters to Melina, given in parenthesis, seemingly an afterthought, suddenly illuminates his writing. Sometimes I think I understand the fall of man better than anyone else.